Then it's already time for introducing the last speaker for today. So, who is Dr. Joe Beck Coleman, who is at the University of Washington Center for an Informed Public. He actually has a background and a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology, which he earned at Princeton. And his research currently focuses on how actions and interactions of group members give rise to broader patterns of collective action. And he's particularly interested in understanding how communication technology alters collective decision-making and the spread of information, which I think is fascinating with an evolutionary biology background. So Joe, I'm really looking forward to your talk.
Thanks so much. I actually, I was Ian's last student at Princeton, saw the whole process of his first 6 years at Constance and how this whole general collective behavior initiative came together. So it's really fun to see it kind of in a mature state where, you know, there are these talks and events, and I'm really grateful to be giving one. I started working on collective behavior, and I was interested in things like locust swarms or fish schools and how they avoid predators and also kind of our own behavior as well. So why do we, all these groups seem to exhibit coordinated behavior in the absence of an obvious leader? And these are kind of distinct phenomena are all called collective behavior over the last 100 years. But for a good chunk of time, we didn't quite understand how it happened. To the extent that early philosophy or theories, you know, had to invoke things like telepathy or thought transference to try to make sense of how this was possible. And of course, you know, work out of a lot of the people actually in this talk and at Constance showed that collective behavior instead emerges from the actions and interactions of individuals. And importantly, it can have function. This is some work from Matt Lutz's PhD, where ants here are following simple rules. They're moving along a pheromone trail. If they get to a little gap, they stop. If someone walks over them, they stay stopped. And these simple rules lead to bridge formation and actually optimally reduce travel time and costs for the ant swarm. So when we think about collective behavior, it's not just these pairwise interactions, but it's actually a network of interactions and information flow. And this happens in ants and, of course, in fish. And it's all kind of part of complexity. More broadly, we can think about flows of other things like nutrients or energy flows. I have a typo there. Or power grids. These are all complex systems in a broader sense. And complex systems have sort of distinct properties. One, as we've heard about a bit here, is emergence. This is John Conway's Game of Life, which I'm sure most folks here are familiar with, where simple rules about birth-death processes on this, you know, spatial grid lead to these emergent patterns. And in working on this talk, I found this example from YouTube where this large-scale thing following Conway's Game of Life actually reproduces itself, which is wild to me and is still kind of blowing my mind. I think this was discovered 2 years ago as well. So even with these simple sort of games, we're still sort of making sense of what can happen. But complex systems also have finite resilience and robustness. So if you imagine you have a functioning power grid of some sort and it gets perturbed, maybe everyone turns their kettle on during a sporting event. If it's not a big perturbation, it can drop back down and get back into its functioning state. But if a perturbation is large enough, so an example in the US is Texas with a giant snowstorm and cold weather snap, it can fail to function and move into some different state, often a non-functional one. And complex systems kind of generally tend to fail or change in a sudden way and unpredictably. They do so catastrophically often and at times irreversibly. And we can see examples of this, of course, with blackouts that I just mentioned, but also ecosystems fail as well. This is a bleached coral reef, and I'm sure we have no shortage of these examples among the ecologists here and anyone who pays attention to the news. And it can happen with collectively behaving systems too. They can also fail. This is an ant mill, and each of these ants is following a pheromone trail. And they're also laying down pheromone trails and they're moving in a circle. And unfortunately, they can get stuck in this state until they all starve to death or luckily reconnect with the main group. This is rare, but it's a great example of how simple rules that normally produce these really fantastic collective emergent behaviors can also go wrong. And so the kind of key part of this talk is that, you know, complex systems functionality is really fragile and context dependent. And when it changes and when that functionality is altered is if you change the scale or structure of the system, if you kind of change what flows along the edges, or if you add feedback. This is just like a general heuristic way of thinking about changing the functionality of a collective system. And this isn't just an abstraction. For our Earth system, we pumped fossil fuels and harvested resources, and now we're heading towards a hothouse Earth, which is a different stable state for our Earth, and one that we don't really like. And if we make the right decisions, then we can maybe stabilize it. But the complex system of our global climate and also our ecosystems is now hitting this sort of heading towards collapse and new functionality. So stepping back a bit, I guess, to humans, you know, what can we infer about our own collective functionality and what that means for things like climate change? So our social adaptations evolved in the context of kind of small hunter-gatherer groups solving local problems through vocalizations and gestures. Like, to whatever extent our behavior is hardwired, this is the context it was hardwired for. But times have changed. We went from, you know, being a small groups of about 100 or so, and then through the agricultural revolution to small towns and gatherings of a few thousand. And with the digital revolution, we now have these online commons that have multiple billions of members communicating and interacting simultaneously. And there's research and evidence from the collective behavior literature and from the complex systems literature that simply changing the scale of a group can alter its ability to do things like what Wataru was talking about with making wise decisions, or also Lisa's talk as well. Changing group size can have an impact and a consequence on accuracy. But it also, the changes in scale allow for changes in structure. So we saw a graph like this earlier. This one is from the Center for an Informed Public from the 2020 election. So these are clusters of people on Twitter. And we see like a political left, a political right, but also this like third cluster of these pro-Trump QAnon activists as well. And this structure is not a natural one for our species. This is not an ecologically relevant structure. And its consequences are largely unknown. But again, as we saw a little bit earlier from the talk and some work from my PhD, collective wisdom can alter, or be altered by polarization and these sort of structures. Consensus can as well. And even contagion dynamics can be changed by structural features of networks. So we've altered our scale and structure, but we've also kind of changed what flows. Historically, we had noisy communication. So if I tell someone something and then they share that story, the story mutates and changes as it goes on and may decay and disappear. But now, it's going slow, sorry. With the internet, we have higher fidelity information flow. And this has been like a trend of communication technology, is we can reproduce information more exactly as it spreads across the network. This might seem good, but there's a lot of evidence both in our own behavior and in other natural systems and offline interactions that behavior tends to decay with distance from sources. And this type of noise can be important for things like coordination and decision-making. So getting rid of noise doesn't necessarily improve collective decision-making, could actually have problems for it. And then, you know, over the course of history, as we got to higher fidelity information transfer, it got more pricey and gatekept. In order to make a TV show, you needed to have money and financing. But the internet has done this really fundamental thing in making high fidelity information transfer very cheap and democratic. And this obviously has some benefits, things like Black Lives Matter or the Me Too movement. People that were historically disenfranchised or aggrieved could come together and affect change. But we also have, you know, the proliferation of false news online and misinformation. In 2016, this was the most shared story on Facebook, and it was a false story about Pope Francis endorsing Trump made on a kind of plausible looking local news website, because there's no real barrier to entry here. And this spread everywhere. So this kind of double-edged sword of cheap and high fidelity information flow that will have some effect on our behavior at scale. We've also added feedback. I mean, this could be a talk in itself, but now most of our information foraging goes through some set of servers in Silicon Valley or throughout the world, where it decides based on what we've done or what others have done, what we should see or do or forage next. And so we've coupled our collective behavior at scale to these opaque algorithms, most of which aren't even publicly disclosed, and require quite a bit of work to understand what they're doing and when they're being used. And to be completely honest, we have very little clue what impact this will have on our collective behavior. So in every possible way that we could change the functionality of our collective behavior from whatever it was, we've done so, and we're doing so at a rapid pace. And these changes have been drastic, opaque, massive in scale, and effectively unregulated globally. And they were brought about not to promote sustainability or human happiness, but really as engineering decisions to optimize corporate profits. So we've basically in 12,000 years gone from solving these local problems through vocal communication to having these like global challenges like pandemics and climate change while communicating on smartphones through a multi-billion member global social network. And so I think, you know, to the point of what can ecology tell us about human collective behavior, this talk is mostly kind of ecology examples, but you know, with this framework and this perspective, it's kind of unreasonable to suggest that a complex system adapted for hunting and gathering, but now mined for attention at scale, can be sustainable without some form of stewardship or care. And we outlined this all in a paper we had out last month in PNAS that I encourage you all to read because it's 4 years worth of work. This is kind of all pie in the sky, but what might this look like, I think, is the question that we reasonably get. And so I'll just give into one example of work from my postdoc of using ecological models and sort of this theory to make sense of things online. So when I first got here from my postdoc, they threw me into the deep end and I joined a rapid response group, led a rapid response group for online misinformation, one of our analysis teams. And there's a report about it all as well. It was a partnership with ourselves and Graphica and the DFR lab at Stanford Internet Observatory. And what happened was we'd see tickets in our system submitted by partners or by members of the group of examples of misinformation online. So in this one, this story came out saying that Ilhan Omar was harvesting ballots and it got retweeted and shared everywhere. And we would respond in real time, trying to see if it was falsifiable, work with election authorities in local areas to get the truth out or to sort out what actually is happening. And work with Twitter and Facebook and other partners to try to remove misinformation as it came about. And a lot of these things, like this is a retweet graph of that. So each dot here or square is a type of interaction with this content on Twitter. The size of it is the scale of the following of the person who tweeted it. You can see this growth is just really exponential. This stuff takes off like wildfire within an hour or two of the story dropping. And one of the more remarkable kind of features of the 2020 US election was a lot of misinformation was pushed forward by the same, you know, dozen or so accounts that would repeatedly work across different incidents, different narratives. They had tons of followers and they would get a lot of engagement. So this has led to really, like, I think, you know, strong conversations in the US, but also globally about how do we confront misinformation? What can we do to fix it? And there's a lot of theories, right? One is you can remove content, just like delete it, find it, delete it. This obviously has ethical costs in terms of censorship and other things. Another possible, you know, option is to slow it down. So you algorithmically downrate misinformation, but you don't remove it entirely. People have also advocated for removing accounts, banning people. And then one of the kind of, you know, trendier things, because it seems less costly, are nudges. So we just encourage people to think more critically and then hope that they sort this out for themselves and that that leads to some sort of emergent reduction in misinformation. And this is a hard question to sort out which of these things we should be doing because we can't ask Twitter to run an experiment, right? There's no way they're going to let us test this at scale. We can try to do theoretical models of it that are purely theory, but we see all this behavior of actual people and how they maybe are coordinating and pushing misinformation. So it's hard to encode that in a reliable way into theory that can be scalable. And similarly with experiments, it's hard to know whether or not what you're capturing in your bottle is going to scale up to this like a large scale information ecosystem with all of these features and polarization and partisanship and everything else. It's a nightmare. Sorry, frozen again. Hopefully, not actually frozen. Yeah, so if we look at these sort of time series though, these are tweets per 5 minutes for one of these narratives. One thing that strikes me is it kind of looks like the COVID cases curves. It looks like disease spread. And there's a lot of reason to believe that information on Twitter, at least in short timescales, can spread like a disease. So an approach that I took is to just see whether or not actually we can use a disease model to capture this. And there's some cool work from Jamie Lloyd-Smith's lab from 2005 on looking at how removing super spreaders impacts the spread of infectious disease. So I adapted some of this, these sort of branching process models to Twitter data. And it's a super simple model, it looks complicated, but just that the expected amount of engagement, like number of people retweeting, is a function of the virality, which is itself, decays with time and kind of increases with exposure, where exposure is just like the total number of followers of accounts that have shared it. So at each time step, people share it, all their followers are possibly exposed to the next time step. They may retweet it, and you know, over time, it either saturates the network or gets replaced by other information, this decay term. And this is that model fit to one of these examples. The dashed line is the model fit, the straight line is, or is the data, the straight line is the model fit, and the shaded area is the 89% credible region for where the model thinks should be. And the reason this seems to work so well is because it's a fairly simple contagion, and we know the distribution of follower sizes that tweeted in every kind of chunk of time. We can kind of plot that same graph a bit differently, where we have time on the x-axis and the cumulative engagement on the y-axis, and we look at the total amount of engagement that happened here, somewhere around 100,000 tweets, I believe. We can do this for a bunch of different incidents. In our data set, we have 220 or so odd incidents that meet criteria, and it seems to fit pretty well across a wide range of different shapes and tendencies of misinformation spread. And of course, we want to quantify this. So here, we take the first time step, and then we simulate out the duration of the event, and we look at how many posts we get in our simulations versus how many we observed. We have a nice match here between theory and the observed thing, except for certain events, which were a little weird. And what's probably happening there is some external forcing, like hit Fox News or maybe coordination. And the cool thing about this model is it allows us to start to play with nudges. So much like you might reduce CO2 in a climate model, we can remove content after 30 minutes. That's the removal condition in brown, or after say 60 minutes, whatever it might be. Or we can slow content after a shorter time period, or we can nudge 10% of users to be inoculated, or we can ban all of the users that have been repeat offenders with more than 50,000 followers, for example. And we can simulate out for each of these 220 incidents how much misinformation we would see had these policies been enacted during the election. And we can do this for all the events we have and sum it up and look at total engagement across the entire election with various different strategies employed. So with content removal, we find that if you're removing here, say 10% of content, because you can't remove everything, you'll never catch it all, and there's ethical challenges, it can have an effect, but it has to be done fairly quickly to reduce misinformation. And the effect is not great. Maybe a 15-20% reduction if you can get that pulled very fast at the 15 minutes, which often is impractical for a number of reasons. For content slowing as well, this is here where you're slowing, I think, 20% of content that's misinforming, which you can maybe slow more because it's less ethically daunting. It also kind of works, but again, requires a fairly rapid thing, is not particularly strong. For account removal, banning totally works. The problem is that you have to ban, here the rule we're applying is everyone with three strikes gets banned if they have at least this number of followers, right? So in order for this to be effective, you have to ban anyone that is a repeat offender with more than here 10,000 followers, which I think is 20 or 30,000 accounts have been removed, which is, you know, non-trivial, and there are a lot of large accounts, and you might not have a lot of public support for this. And then a final approach, you know, these nudges, they can work, but you need to get somewhere near 40% efficacy. So nearly half of people who are nudged just don't share it, which is kind of in the realm of science fiction. I think we'll be lucky to see 5 or 10%. So all of these strategies for reducing misinformation don't particularly work in regions that are not like draconian or science fiction. And that's a concern, but you know, one thing we tried, of course, here is what happens if you just combine these in plausible levels of enforcement. So here on the left, we have a modest version of it where we have like, you know, 20% of information, I think it is, decays, there's a 10% nudge or 5% nudge. We ban people, but only if they have more than like 100,000 followers. And we combine all these things together, we get nearly a 50% reduction in misinformation across the entire, you know, election disinfo campaign. And if we're a little bit more aggressive, but still very plausible for enforcement, we can see even greater reductions. So like the gestalt of this suggests that these strategies in isolation aren't likely to have the effect we want, but if we combine them, we can probably have something useful and effective. And more generally, these sort of models can provide insight when we can't run experiments and when we can't, you know, necessarily just purely theoretically derive out a solution. And so this is actually all in line with code and data to reproduce it. Feel free to play with it. If you find an error, please let me know. That'd be great. It's currently in review, but there's a preprint up. So thanks so much. And thanks to my funders and thanks to the hosts here. This has been a really, really cool and invigorating meeting, which is unusual in the age of Zoom.
Yeah, thank you so much, Joe. This was fascinating. So we've taken it from meerkats all the way to misinformation online. I'm really happy about that. And I take the liberty of asking the first question. You probably get this asked a lot. Who defines what is misinformation? I mean, there are some clear cases. If somebody claims the earth is flat, it's pretty clear. But there's other cases where I think it's clear, but others may disagree. So if somebody claims that homeopathy works beyond placebo, I think it's misinformation because it's disproven, but who decides on that? I would even go further and say that all religion is kind of alternative facts. But then again, who's the Ministry of Truth who decides, and is deliberately polemic here, who decides what kind of information you should actually try to get rid of from the internet?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So in the case of this study, at least, everything here was a falsifiable statement about the election that we were able to fact check as being incorrect. So, for example, some of this was someone saying the way you vote is this way when it's not. And that is, you know, trying to confuse voters or saying that ballots are being burned in a dumpster. And we called the election authority and they said these are 2-year-old things being recycled. This is actually a real case. We have to recycle them eventually. We didn't even burn them. We just threw away old envelopes because we have to get rid of paper. So that kind of misinformation, I feel like hopefully we can agree as a society that when you can truly fact check something in a way that only the most motivated person would disagree with, that those things are misinformation. But you're right there, especially when we get outside of the science realm into, you know, things that harm people but aren't not necessarily grounded in facts, such as your feeling about towards a group of people. Like, is that a fact or is that just harmful in some other way? I think that one of the challenges is going to be to create networks that endogenously produce, you know, truth or stability without some sort of top-down control. But, you know, a trade-off with that is until we sort out how to make collectively wise networks, until Wataru figures that out for us, we are stuck with, you know, people not getting vaccinated and dying from misinformation. So we have to make a decision somewhere, right? There's going to be costs and trade-offs for sure.
Thank you. Ari.
Hey, great talk, Joe. Super interesting. So I was actually had a relatively specific question, which is when you were talking about these combined interventions, which seem really promising, is that a kind of synergistic effect or is it just kind of an additive thing? And are there certain like combos that are especially good because of some weird interaction between them, or how does that all work?
It's a little hard to say. So because the way we simulate this is we draw from each time step from the people that had tweeted in that time frame, we're conditioning on the actual behavior of the users. So like if, for instance, big accounts tweet earlier, we're conditioned on that, which is nice. But it also makes interpretation of what's synergy and what's not a little hard because you're so heavily conditioned on the data. It's roughly additive in terms of the actual percent reduction. But there might be combinations where it's non-additive and there might be events where it's definitely non-additive, right? Like, for example, for some events, a nudge plus removing one of the big users early might actually just tank it to zero really fast. But for other events that are kind of driven by a lot of smaller accounts, these might have no effect whatsoever, right? None of these policies, except for maybe the nudge. And so there's some synergy, but there's also some some redundancy as well. And it's non-trivial. My cat is saying hi. I think he's mad I've been too busy.
Lisa is next, I think, with honesty in animals.
Yeah, that was a really great talk. It was really great to hear what you've been up to. I think about these topics a lot, just kind of casually within the context of like the study of honesty in animal communication and how a lot of signals are kept honest because of the cost of producing them. So if you are producing a mating signal, it's tied to some aspect of your quality, and that can prevent cheating in a lot of circumstances and things like that. And you had mentioned that in the past, there were kind of these costs to entering the conversation. So if you submit an article to the New York Times or something like that, like you had this barrier that you had to get through in order to be seen that is not there anymore. And you mentioned that there are some benefits of that that not being there. But I was just curious if you had any casual thoughts about whether there is a way of adding some kind of cost back to presenting information that might help in these contexts.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I would actually, when I was writing the paper, one of our co-authors pointed out that actually there's not only is there not costs to producing bad information, there's benefits to it, right? Like, you know, anti-vax misinformation leads to these giant, you know, followings that you can actually monetize. And if you look at the like anti-vax QAnon folks on Instagram, they're all selling like one of three tonics or something, right? Like they have these sort of like, instead of the vaccine, take this juice, you know? So there are benefits to misinformation. So like, that's a huge problem. And then if we can add costs back, I mean, there's definitely ways to do it, right? It could be through banning or removal or you know, like shadow banning. That's a cost if you're aware of it. But how do we do it in a way that doesn't, like, this is a million-dollar question. Like, how do we do that in a way that doesn't, like, totally block off the, you know, ability for people who experience violence to speak up about that and have that addressed in a public forum? Like, how do we have that, but then, you know, maybe not have anti-vaccine misinformation? Then where does like the flat earth society fall on this? Because it's fairly harmless, but it's wrong, you know?
Yeah.
No idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great question. If you can solve it, please do. Yep, at night.
Last question on this talk, I take from Helge, and then we move on to have a panel discussion among all of us.
Yeah. So obviously, great talk. I think we have a lot of shared interests. There were different angles. So my question is about whether the polarization we observe in those networks, whether this is just a consequence of opinions already held, and compared to being an effect of the polarization within the network. So basically, whether it's rather a result of a polarized society that is just mirrored in the social networks, and particularly in the USA, or whether the network basically formed this polarized society. So in your talk, you basically indicate that the cause and effect is that the cheap communication is the cause for the polarization, but it may just visualize a society that has already been divided.
That's a great question. So I think that part of it is that I think polarization is a phenomenon that's scale dependent. If we were 100 person groups, I don't think we would see three giant clusters that never interact at the rates we see online. So I think there's, you know, in the most like extreme version of it, some version of polarization has been caused by the growth in scale and communication technology, that sort of thing. Now, with social media stuff, whether or not it's causing or driving polarization is this like giant academic debate that's starting to feel more and more like if greenhouse gases cause global warming. Like, we have a lot of kind of circumstantial evidence, but it is, like you said, hard to prove because there was some latent polarization beforehand and is increasing still. But how much of that is moderated by, say, recommendation algorithms or whatnot? And the challenge with answering this is we don't have the data we need. I like to joke that this is like studying climate change if you don't have access to the thermometers because BP owns them. So if we found, for example, that the recommendation algorithms, if you simulated out, drive polarization, that would be really informative. So I think it's a great question. I think in the extreme, polarization is a feature of communication technology, but whether or not Twitter or Facebook is driving it specifically is something that my guess is yes. Honestly, like just based on my totally heuristic read of like what gets recommended to me and what doesn't. But yeah, it's an open question, I think.
Yes. So I mean, I would agree that it probably shows the phenomenon. It's more difficult. So for instance, we're working also on the vaccine case specifically, and I've the feeling that the topic more and more gets hijacked by political identity, which is basically the core behind it.
Yeah.
At least in the US debate again. Which should have nothing to do with the logic or rationale for or against a certain vaccine, but basically you cannot think it separately apparently anymore in that society at least.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.